Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, an animation filmmaker tells a folklore story from her native country of Ukraine. Then a visual artist tells a touching story about a Muni driver that changed his life, and a play that connects an ancient Aztec story to the present. The common thread for today's show is about being colorful and vibrant in our storytelling. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Have you ever been trying to do something like really, really important, but there's that annoying negative voice inside that tears you down? Award-winning filmmaker Masha Ellsworth captures dealing with the tormenting inner critic in the animated short Little T. Masha is the lead technical director at Pixar. And if you're a Pixar fan, you've definitely seen her work. But Little T is her own independent work. Masha is originally from Ukraine, but lives in the East Bay Area. We talked about her career path, the inspiration behind Little T, and how she's retelling a well-known story in Ukrainian folklore. Masha Ellsworth, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. I am so excited. I love talking to animators because I love animation. So anytime I get to talk to one, I'm very, very happy.
Well, I'm so happy to be here and answer any of your questions.
Yay! Okay, well, first question is, what inspired you to be an animator?
Well, you know, this makes a lot of people laugh. I had not a very straight path in my career. The short answer is watching MTV.
Okay, Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, that era. You know, I was born in, I grew up in Ukraine in the 90s, and MTV was this first channel that we got from outside of Ukraine. And so all the teenagers were obsessed about it. And I wanted to become an architect like my dad, but my dad didn't want me to be an architect because the economy wasn't great. And he was like, a woman, like on a construction site, like no one will listen to you. So I was really upset. I was like, I'm just going to go watch my MTV and in my room. And I saw a boys band that was called Take That.
Okay.
It's a British boys band. And they had this video of a girl hacker, and she looked so cool in that video. And I decided I'm going to rebel and I'm going to do like computer science. I just thought like, oh, I can do this.
Okay.
And I know this is a roundabout way of saying how I got to animation. And I learned the computer science first, but there was something about art that still pulled me back. Like I still had that itch that I wanted to like follow, like just like my dad. And so I decided to double major in art and computer science in college. And I did not know that's like a perfect fit for animation.
And so you have done well in your career. You are the lead technical director at Pixar. Mm-hmm. And how did you get to Pixar?
So I was in college really semester before graduating. And I just found out about this thing called animation. Like, I knew about animation, of course, but I didn't know that I could have a career in it because it's just not talked about how science and art is this perfect fit for computer graphics and computer animation. And finally, someone told me that Pixar comes to my college, Brigham Young University, and they recruit from there. And it was a surprise for me. And I felt like, oh my gosh, I only have one semester. I felt like I lost my chance. Mm-hmm. And I had the summer before that semester, and I wanted to learn everything I could about animation. And I volunteered on a bunch of student films and build up my portfolio. So then when Pixar came, they picked me as one of the interns.
And what films have you worked on? What Pixar films have you worked on?
So I started on Ratatouille,
oh,
which is just what a gem of a film to start your career with.
Now, were you an intern or were you already hired?
I was an intern. Yeah, I was an intern, you know, doing my best, dressing sauces in the kitchen, you know, like dressing, said dressing leaves on the streets of Paris, just trying to do really my best. And after that, I got hired and I worked on Up, another film that just, I cannot watch it without crying.
Oh, me neither.
And so in my career, I have worked on over a dozen of Pixar films, and most recent one was Inside Out 2, which, you know, was such another heartfelt film that felt very timely and resonated with people on like in a deeper level. Yeah.
So these, you know, very emotional driven films that you've worked on, that those of us who are kids at heart, those of us who are little kids, when we saw them for the first time, we still carry those memories, you know, of those films, which is funny because you're naming these films and I'm thinking of your independent work. So this is not connected with Pixar. Mm-hmm. Little T, which is also too a very powerful film. Mm-hmm. It's a story I think definitely most people can relate to, about a young woman. Her name's Alexis. She has an interview for her dream job, but there's that voice in her head. We all know that voice that just beats her up. Yeah. Let's hear a clip.
Can I get the chicken kale salad? No bacon and no croutons.
And let me guess, dressing on the side?
Actually, no dressing.
Is that all?
Well, and a triple chocolate cupcake.
Yeah, live a little. I'll get it for you.
A cupcake? I was only gonna have one bite.
One bite? Only one bite? You always say this, and then you pig out. Your interview is in 2 hours. You're gonna crash. You have no money, and then you will end up living under an overpass. Or even worse, back at Mom and Dad's.
It's just one bite.
It is never just one bite with you.
Excuse me, your lunch.
So, Masha, this film is only 7 minutes long, but it really hits your heart. Where did the concept from this film come from?
So, at the time of making this film, I just hit my 10-year anniversary at work. And we have this little celebration for people that like hit that milestone. And a lot of mixed emotions were running through my head. You know, I was so happy, like, wow, I didn't even notice 10 years have passed. And I'm like, what a privilege it is to have a job where you like really love every day. And at the same time, I felt like, oh my gosh, is this it? Mm. And I felt stuck because I was also scared of making a fool out of myself, mm-hmm. You know, big imposter syndrome, and just feeling like, well, there's so many talented people already doing what I want to do. Like, who needs me there? And one day, I have happened to be at a Chinese fast food restaurant where me and my son love to go to and get their orange chicken.
Okay.
And we love to get the fortune cookies. It's like our thing. And it was the only time where I opened the fortune cookie and the message was so timely. And it said, silence the critic within. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that fortune cookie was like the answer. It was like, oh, this is what I'm feeling. I want to do something. I have a lot of ideas of what I could do, but there's part of me, my critical part, that is keeping me from doing it. And I decided to research, like, what is this inner critic? Who's this part of us? You know, why did I get one and how do I silence it? So I read a lot of books, like popular psychology books to like psychology research, just trying to understand what I'm feeling. And at the end of it, I felt like, oh my gosh, I want to share this. And it dawned on me that making this film will become my next challenge. Mm.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with filmmaker and animator Masha Ellsworth. And we're talking about her film Little T, which is a film that makes us confront that inner critic that can be really, really brutal. You know, what I found interesting is that the young woman, Alexis,
So she has the inner critic and she has the little child inside. Oh. And so the little child inside looks like a little version of Alexis, you know. Yeah. But that negative voice looks nothing like her. That inner critic looks nothing like her. And I thought that was really interesting. Why does the inner critic and the child inside, they look so differently from Alexis?
I found that, you know, when you start researching your inner critic or in popular maybe media, it's like, oh, it's like your mom's voice. But if you look at research, it just have to be an authority figure, like those voices, those lingering feelings form in our head. It's usually something that was happening in our childhood that we couldn't frame properly, like our brains couldn't process it or didn't have someone who could help us process it. And very often it's an authority figure. It could be a coach, you know, a teacher or someone you look up to. But over time, that voice becomes very negative. There's no boundary with it. And some maybe innocent remarks, when you play them over and over in your head, become critical.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't know that that voice can be someone that you respected, but was very critical of you. Interesting. Yeah, because I said, was that her mom? Is that her former boss or a teacher? Yeah, I was like, ooh. But I love the little child inside, because the little child inside is like, you're enough. And so you have another beautiful work. So not only are you a great storyteller, just as far as with the writing, but also too, we didn't even talk about the animation. And I was really just captivated by your current film that's hitting the film festival circuit called Bound. And the animation is so cool because it looks like a cross-stitching pattern, which I thought was really, really neat. And so, okay, so I know this, I understand that this story comes from some Ukrainian folklore.
Yeah.
So tell us about this story, about this couple, and how you brought it to us through animation.
Absolutely. So like many folk songs, you know, the tune is very catchy, and I grew up with this song, and, you know, everyone kind of hums it and sings it. And it's a love song. In a traditional sort of interpretation, it's like a sad love song. The interpretation that I grew up with is, you know, young boy meets young woman on the pastures in Ukraine, you know, medieval Ukraine, and they meet and they flirt a little. And the boy says, well, I'll come visit you. And the girl says, like, yeah, come back. The next verse is, the boy is upset and he says, like, well, I came to visit you and you stood me up, and sort of like he's upset for some reason. And the girl's like, well, I was there, like, come back. So the song itself is very catchy. When you analyze the lyrics or listen to the lyrics, like, you're like, wow, something is going on there.
Right.
Something happened. There's definitely some kind of misunderstanding. And traditionally, it's believed that, like, oh, it's the girl is playing hard to get. And I, as I was growing up, I always felt like, no, that's not fair. This song does not say anything about her playing hard to get or being difficult, or, you know, she says that, like, she didn't know. So it kind of bothered me for a long time. And I felt like, okay, it is time to update the interpretation of the story. And I feel like the song is missing a verse. That's how I like to frame it. The verse that explains it all is missing because it's such an old song. And I grew up and I was born in Ukraine, and cross-stitching tradition runs deep in Ukraine. Mm. You know, people in Ukraine say that our DNA is cross-stitched. Like that's how much we're into cross-stitch. And so when thinking about the visual style of the story, I knew that I wanted to make it look like cross-stitch. And the film kind of questions, like, will their love be enough? Like, will their connection survive? Which I thought was a more modern interpretation.
Did you do two different versions of the film? Like, did you do one in English and then one in your native language?
I already recorded the song in Ukrainian with Ukrainian musicians and Ukrainian vocalists. And I have subtitles in English for people that don't understand Ukrainian. But also the way the visual style is done that way that you understand what's happening without needing to understand every word.
Let's hear a little bit of the song. And what's the name of the song?
Nese Gala Vodu, which means Gala carries buckets of water.
Okay, let's hear that.
Nese Gala Vodu.
What was that like for you to record with these musicians and vocalists?
It was so special to hear the sounds I grew up with. I knew I missed those sounds, but it's like when you hear those sounds, and we recorded a Ukrainian instrument called bandura. Imagine like a harp and a guitar had a child. It looks pretty unique.
Okay.
And it just sounds so wonderful. And so hearing that in the recording studio and having like professional musicians perform was so touching. It was so great.
Masha Ellsworth, thank you so much. And thank you for just using your art and your storytelling to touch the child heart in all of us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a privilege to share my story and to be here and talk to you listeners. Thank you.
That was animator and filmmaker Masha Ellsworth. You can catch Little T on Masha's website, and we'll have a link on KALW's Sights and Sounds page. Next up, an artist shows love to Muni drivers one drawing at a time. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. I love and appreciate our Bay Area bus drivers so much. It's not an easy job, but they get us to our locations. And for artist Kurt Schwartzman, one bus driver did more than that when he was homeless. She was a catalyst that later led to Kurt getting off the streets. Kurt draws these bright and colorful portraits of Muni drivers, buses, and the streets of San Francisco. And his fashion is just as bright as his work. And he's here in studio to chat with me about his artistry. Welcome, Kurt. Hey.
Hey, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy. I met you like a week ago, and then like now you're here. And before we even just kick off into the interview, just really, you know, dive deep, you have put a smile on my face with your fashion.
Yeah.
That, like, when I noticed the fashion the first time I saw you. So for people listening, so Kurt and I, we got something in common. We love the bus. We're bus drivers, we're bus riders, and we love the bus. Mm-hmm. And so you have on a Muni, a brown cap with the Muni logo on it, and you have this gorgeous, beautiful, bright, multicolored jacket. It almost looks like a sunset because there's pinks and oranges and browns, and then you have this brown t-shirt with a Muni logo on it, and then you have some, as you called, your hippie flower child pants. So yeah, so Curtis Stylish, and he has a patch on his eye, which is for his disability. However, it works with his style.
Yes, thank you.
Did I get it right?
You got it right, but you forgot to mention my shoes.
Uh-oh, wait a minute. Hello! And then he got bright yellow bus shoes.
Yeah.
With a matching backpack. Okay.
Okay.
Right. So now that we painted the picture, well, first of all, where did you get your style from?
So I get my style from online. There's a company called MrTurk.com.
Okay.
And they sell a lot of blazers that are full of color, quality, and they embrace color. They embrace bold.
Yeah.
So.
Were you always someone who embraced color? Because I know for some people, like, I like wearing bright colors too,
right,
even though I don't have on any right now. But some people, they're scared to wear bright colors, but you are like all out with it.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I started picking clothing that embraced colorful, bold solids.
Yeah.
And so it was quite a leap. And you're right. I do hear people say, wow, I wish I could wear color. It's like, well, you can. Just put it on as I go outside and spread the love.
Well, definitely it put a smile on my face. It must make other people smile, too,
yes,
to see.
Yes, it does.
I can see that. So, again, you know, you have this incredible story, you know, as far as this bus driver.
Yes.
So tell us, how did this bus driver help you? How did they change your life?
Okay, well, I was homeless in 2007. I'd been wandering the streets. Sometimes I felt like a rat in a maze, always moving but really going nowhere. Mm-hmm. And this particular early morning hour, I wandered over to the 52 Night Owl bus stop, sat down. I was just tired of walking. And the bus rolled up and the doors opened and the driver said, come on aboard. I'm like, I can't. I don't have any money for the fare. And she said, come on aboard anyways. Keep me company. And it was the first time in days where somebody had seen me. Mm. Being homeless felt transparent at times, or worse, I was in society's way. Mm. And this bus driver saw me and invited me in. And I boarded her bus, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, thank you. Thank you for seeing me. And I wish I would have gotten her name, because here it is years later, if I had her name, I could go find her and say, thank you for changing the direction of my life. Mm-hmm. It's like, it was, I'm very grateful.
So first of all, that's just a touching story. You know, I end my show every episode with take care of yourself and take care of each other. And that's why when I hear things like that, because it makes a difference when we look out for each other.
It does. Well, I went from being outside the bus to being inside the bus, where I was safe and warm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What was it about that transaction, or just the interaction with that driver, that led you to, I guess, getting yourself together?
Right. I was homeless for about 6 months, living on the streets of San Francisco for about 6 months. And when she saw me, I remember days after that, I was, I started reaching out to my social worker and started volunteering. Because of her kindness, it transformed me into thinking, hey, how can I get out of this?
Yeah.
So
just feeling seen is, and you know, that's what, to me, that's what artists do. Like, they help us, you know, feel seen.
Right.
And I feel like your work, in a sense, does that. Well, definitely,
well, you.
Your work helps muni drivers and other bus drivers feel seen. So go ahead.
After that bus driver, many years later in 2015, when I was taking art classes at Fort Mason City College campus, one of the assignments was to create a series. So I created a series in honor of all muni operators, because they work very hard and they're underappreciated.
Yes, they do work hard.
And the series I'm working on now is Portraits of Muni Service. And that's when I board a bus with my art supplies and I sit down. I look for the driver's eyes in their rearview mirror. As soon as I find their eyes, I draw their eyes. And then I draw their nose and their mouth, and I draw their portrait.
Yeah.
Then I build the composition around their image.
Wow. So how did they react when they see you?
Well, it's like,
do they see you draw?
Yeah. Well, okay. Sometimes they're like, they're looking at me and I'm looking at them, and I'm trying not to distract them because they're driving the bus.
Right.
Although sometimes they want to talk. And I'll ask them questions like, well, why did you choose Muni to work for? And how long have you been driving? Mm. And you're driving excellent. It's like, we're all on this bus and we trust you.
Right.
So it's like, hey, thank you for your service.
Yeah, and especially too when they're going up those hills.
Oh, yeah. The hills, yeah. In fact, I met this one driver on the One California, and her name was Nicole,
okay.
N-I-K-O-L.
Okay.
She had this big smile, and it turns out she had only been driving for 2 weeks, and it was like, and she was climbing those hills and going down those really steep, not inclines, but declines.
Yeah.
And at the end of the line, I put my drawing in a frame, and I handed it to her, and I said, thank you for your service. You matter. You are appreciated. And the energy that's created from just a random act of kindness,
yes.
It's electric. It's to me, it's like pure white light love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine how she felt, especially because she was a rookie. And,
right. Yeah. I could have sworn she'd been driving for like 30 years because she was just a natural.
She was
at
a natural.
It.
At
yeah.
It. Wow. I've been on the bus with like AC Transit drivers and they're new. And I know that's, you know, it can be scary. And when I get off the bus, I thank them and I'm like, keep going.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Actually, I think a lot of us, well, I don't like to use the word should, so I'll just simply say it'd be helpful for the drivers to hear, thank you, driver.
Yeah.
So when you step off the bus, try to say out loud, thank you, driver, or thank you, operator.
Yeah, I definitely do that. Is there any story you could like that may come to mind of just when you gave someone a portrait? Because I know I would feel touched, like to see something, like to experience that.
Well, pretty much I do have a few drivers, like... I met this driver named Rico Suave. His real name is not Rico Suave.
Okay.
But when I boarded his bus and I started drawing his portrait, he goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm drawing. He goes, what are you drawing? I said, I'm drawing your portrait in the rearview mirror. He goes, well, you can call me Rico. I said, Rico? He goes, Rico Suave.
Okay.
And he has a big personality. He'd been driving for 30, maybe 25 years or so. And he was touched, and I was touched. And I do it from the kindness of my heart.
Yeah.
I'm not handing them just a piece of paper. I'm putting it in a frame so then they can take it home and, you know enjoy it.
Yeah. So. Now, I have a question, because I know you're blind in your left eye.
Correct.
So how does that impact as far as...
Right.
With, and your art, and again, I love your artwork. It's
Thank
so
you.
Colorful. And like I said, I love the bus. I love the streets. It's just so community. I just love it. It's just the people, the community.
Yes. You know? It's the Muni. It's the community within Muni.
Yes.
The Muni within community.
There you go. No, right, and you capture that so much. So like, how does that affect you as far
right.
as when you're drawing?
So what I learned from taking... beginning, intermediate, and advanced drawing classes is I see in 2D, whereas if you have two eyes, you see in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing in 2D, I see the world as flat.
Okay.
When I'm drawing, that helps me distinguish sight, measuring. It makes drawing much easier and simpler.
Okay.
So I use it to my advantage. Because when I'm drawing a portrait, I can easily exclude everybody on my left side.
Yeah.
So all I'm seeing is you or the person in front of me.
Okay.
So it makes it easier.
Okay, so there's an advantage.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with artist Kurt Schwartzman, and he has a line of his cards on sale at the San Francisco Market Street Railway Museum gift shop, and he draws and creates so many beautiful images of Muni and the streets of San Francisco. Now, you're not paid by Muni. You're not partnered with Muni.
I'm a Muni lover. I'm all about supporting Muni in a way that I honestly think that in this day and age with the driverless cars, that we need a heartbeat behind the wheel. So I like to come up with a slogan for if Muni's going to be hiring operators, how about this? Be the heartbeat behind the wheel. We need you.
All right, somebody from Muni listening. Okay.
All right.
And pay them. Well, you know, a lot of people are concerned about that, right? As you know, we're looking at Waymos, and,
right.
you know, and we talked about this earlier, just the importance of having that human connection because, you know, just how that bus stopped for you.
Right.
That bus driver stopped for you, and you needed a human,
right.
you know, a human connection.
Yeah, and also I think humanity is very important. It's like, I think there's room on the road for all of us, but we need all of us there. It can't just be robots and driverless. We need human the human touch.
And I'm also touched, speaking of human touch, I'm also touched by your artwork of the streets of San Francisco. And what's powerful to me about your story is that, you know, there was a time when you were living on the streets.
Correct.
And I can only imagine how hard that is.
It was hard.
And right now, the image of the streets of San Francisco in our media is not good.
I hear you.
And you draw these beautiful pictures of the streets of San Francisco, and they are so colorful, just reflecting to me the colorful vibrancy of the city.
Right.
Yeah.
So with my streets of San Francisco, the format is 11 inches long, 30 inches wide, and that's the size of a bus ad. And so it's like when you're sitting inside the bus and you're reading all those ads, I have envisioned one day I'm going to have enough drawings to fill the bus.
Yeah.
So you can like see all my work in one bus.
Oh, that would be
That'd
so
be cool.
That would be cool.
Yeah. And so I love drawing like standing at the top of California and looking all the way down to the bay. It's amazing how you can like stand there and see sailboats floating by at the very end, like down past the Embarcadero.
Yeah. So what do you see as an artist? Like, what is it about? I mean, I know too, just San Francisco is hilly. I'm just saying, like, what is, as an artist, what do you like about creating these images of the streets of San Francisco?
Right. Well, for me, I love San Francisco. San Francisco is home to me like no other place has ever been.
And you're from Fresno.
Yes, I am. And Fresno is a great place to be from. It's Fresno. Yes, I'm all about celebrating my hometown. And so, but San Francisco, when I moved here in the 90s, I moved here to live my life authentically. Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot of love for our city, for the people, the weather, and our beautiful streets.
Yeah. Okay, so since you are a professional expert muni writer, what are some of your most, like, scenic, you know,
scenic routes?
Yeah, scenic routes. Because sometimes, okay. I got lost. I was at Stern Grove, and the bus driver, because they had to shut down, like, some of the muni rail, and so they had to redivert buses, and the bus driver got lost, and so we were riding in circles on Twin Peaks.
Wow.
And nobody could...
That must have been the 37 Corbett, I think.
And nobody complained. We were kind of like, it was like a beautiful, you know, view.
Yeah, it's a scenic ride.
Right.
Yeah,
so what's your favorite scenic ride?
One of my favorites is the One California, because it has beautiful views of the Transamerica Pyramid, which I believe is the most beautiful skyscraper in San Francisco.
And you definitely show that in your image that you made of that.
Yeah.
Of that skyscraper.
And also the 22 Fillmore. It's like that route. It goes through many different neighborhoods and goes clear out to the bay,
yeah,
which is gorgeous.
Okay, I have to make a mental note for that. So you're a retired chef and baker.
A pastry chef.
Pastry chef, okay, and baker. And you brought us some cookies.
Yes.
You brought us some chocolate chip caramel cookies.
Yes.
So not only does he put love in his art, ladies and gentlemen and peoples, he put love in his cooking.
Yes. Did you know what? Being a baker, I learned it's the kiss at the end of every meal. So the cookies I brought you is made from love and for all you guys that I love so much.
Well, I felt that love definitely, again, in the cookies. They're so, so good. Real quick, we have like maybe 30 seconds. What are you working on? Anything you want people to know about?
Okay, so I'm putting my fashion together. I love my style. I'm learning about color and how embracing it just lightens up my world and the world around. So I bought a lot of my clothes at themunistore.com.
Okay.
And also the San Francisco Market Street Railway Museum gift shop.
Yes.
And Fluvog Shoes, FLUEVOG.com.
Okay.
And their shoes are unique, quality. And the brand is about love and support.
Okay, so that's what, if we want to copy you, then that's where we can go.
Yes.
Get our style.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't know if you were saying, like, you might have your own line of clothing.
Maybe someday.
I can see it. I can see it. Kurt, you are a person I could tell, or I could just say, that makes me love San Francisco.
I love the people here, and thank you so much for having me here. I'm having a ball.
Oh, thank you. All right. That was artist Kurt Schwartzman. Check out his artwork on his website, yellowlineart.com. And coming up, a contemporary play about a young man on parole who looks to an ancient mythical past to find hope for his future. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. So years ago, an elder told me that sometimes you have to know where you've been to know where you're going. And that lesson came up for me when I learned of the show Aslan. It's about a young man on parole who wants a better future for himself. His life and the ancient land of Aslan magically merge together. And Aslan is a beautiful, mythical homeland of the Aztec people. Aslan is also the name of the play's main character. The show ties together 959 years of history to the present. And you can see Aslan at the Magical Theater in San Francisco until July 13th. And here with me is the show
show's playwright, Luis Alfaro. I hope I pronounced that right.
He's also,
okay, good. He's also a MacArthur Fellow and director of the MFA in dramatic writing at my alma mater, Fight On, the University of Southern California. Woo woo! And also here is Sean San Jose. He is co-founder of the performance group Campo Santo and the lead director of the Magic Theater. Hey, gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Hello. Big fan, Janae. Love the show. KLW.
Thank you. I appreciate you. And I'm so happy you're here and made the time because I know you guys are busy and with the show, and I've heard some good things about it. Luis, let me start with you. Can you just tell us briefly like about Aslan? Because when I read about it, it kind of sounds like the Garden of Eden. And I know it was like some mythology where like the Aztecs were there under the mythology, like they were there and then they left. And because I feel a real tight connection with that storyline and the story of the young man in this play.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to do was just connect us to our history. I started very early with a line that a parole officer says to our lead character, Aslan, who has just gotten out of prison. And he says, "You used to be a king and now you're just a Mexican."
Mm.
And which is a really harsh line, right? And he says, "Let's figure out how we're going to go back and reclaim ourselves." And I started to slowly think about this notion or this idea of redemption, because more than half of all young men in the California correctional facility who get out will go back at least once in their lifetime. So what is that about?
Right.
And so, you know, those questions plague me and plague me in a hard way. I was born and raised in downtown Los Angeles, and my family legacy is the Central Valley. So I come from a family from Delano, California, farm workers. And so, you know, this idea of who we are and where we came from, the notion of migration, right? And how far do we go back, right? And so in this play, in a very, hopefully in an entertaining way, I'm going back and I want to revisit those people 22 generations ago who made it the opportunity for me to be here today, to be able to do what I do, which is almost ridiculously incomprehensible to me that I am a playwright, right? Because I was born and raised into complete abject poverty and violence in the neighborhood that I grew up in downtown Los Angeles. And so I think now, wow, 22 generations ago, thousands of years ago, right? A mythical or a real city existed. And we were a society and a civilization that was inventive, that was full of leadership, that was full also of belief in spirit and belief in the larger world, meaning gods. And, you know, so a lot of this play is invested in animal mythology as well. So everybody that you meet in this play is not who you think they are.
So, oh, I love that.
Yeah. So the parole officer is actually.
Hold on, Luis. Not too many spoilers now.
I won't spoil it. But, you know, there's really something lovely about trying to go back yourself. As I'm Chicano, right? Mexican American. And trying to go back and sort of discover where I came from and who we were and conquered civilizations and all of that. So yeah, it's been little by little unpacking truth. And like people who do the what is that thing where they test your saliva and then you go back and kind of try to figure
out. The
DNA test.
DNA,
right?
Yeah.
So for me, it's kind of unpacking my grandmother, my great grandmother, and then I just started to go back and really go back.
Yeah.
And so that's been sort of the joy of the play, is trying to understand that there's something always for us as people of color. There's always something bigger for us, our history, our lineage, our the people that carry us, that envelop us and hold us in their arms are actually not the people that are still alive today.
You know, it reminds me, you know, in West African culture, particularly Ghana, there's the Sankofa bird, and where the bird is turned, is the image of this bird where his head is turned looking to the back and his feet are walking forward. And that's what came to mind as far as looking back and going forward. And I want to bring Sean in, who is a character in this play. And Sean, people are excited because you've returned to the stage, because so often when your name comes up, you're working behind the scenes. So tell us about this character you play, and how does it feel to be acting on stage?
Well, it feels great to be in anything new and anything that's responding to the times that we live in. And we're just lucky at the Magic Theater and with the group Campo Santo, it's always been about responding to this wild world we live in. So it feels great to be able to do that and to focus on this world that feels so real to me. You all are talking about mythology, but somehow Luis Alfaro was able to write on a couple of different planes at the same time. You know, the mythology within and also the everyday reality of Highway 99. And I think to have that opportunity is, well, first of all, it's healing and it's releasing. And it's also just a great reflection. And all these great writers that we get to work with, they're so necessary because as it turns out, we're living in hell right now. As it turns out, you know, people are being kidnapped, brown people in particular, black people in particular. And so to have a play that's responding to that in a non-political way, in a very personal way, in a very historical way, feels necessary. And so that doesn't feel great, but it feels vibrant and alive.
Well, too, and a lot of people are, you know, looking to their ancestors, right, for answers who have experienced. We know, like, a lot of what's going on now is not new. You know, it looks a little different, but it's, you know, but it's not new. And I know a lot of people are looking to the past to try and figure out the future and how to go forward. Sean, what character do you play? Tell us about your character.
Well, you know, as we're talking about the character Aslan, everything revolves around this brother of the family who's just returning from a 9-year bid in prison in North Kern. And if any of us take a scenic drive down Highway 99, we'll know that we can stop at more new prisons than we can stop at a new church or a new school. Mm-hmm. So that's one of our big stops along the way in this beautiful and horrific state. Sort of the energy of the play, beautiful and horrific all at once. And I play his older brother, Mikantlikutli, which is the mythological name and the given name of the character, but you know how we do. He's called Mickey in the play. So I play Mickey, and I think it ends up being the darker force that is both pulling at his past and pulling at his present that Aslan has to fight through. Mm. And so it has both mythological and very everyday reality energy to both of it.
What does it say about family, you know, in this play too as well? And I'm thinking too, just as far as anybody who's had a family member that's been incarcerated, just, you know, just that stress and also to the happiness and the joyfulness when they get out. But there's also that question of, well, what are we going to do? Because this person has a record. And unfortunately, our society is not always as forgiving of people, you know, who are trying to change their lives and they may have, you know, a record. So.
I mean, I think it says a lot. I think that one of the great things about Alfaro's plays and a lot of the plays that he deal with Highway 99, which is one of our great veins in the state, which means it's a great vein in our country. You know, that's where more than half of our food in this country comes from the backs and fingers of people on their knees down there. And it also is, like I just mentioned, where our new industry in this country is, the prison industrial complex is quote unquote thriving. So I think both of those worlds are present in it too. And I think therefore thus, you know, agricultural life is part of family life and now prison life is a part of family life. And so I think the play deals with that. One of the great things about being able to be in the play is that it's like looking at, almost like looking at encyclopedia books. You could look at a different book of a different theme every night. One is family, one is Central Valley, one is Delano, one is the prison industrial complex, one is mythology, one is the gods and goddesses within us, and it's all in there at once. And I think, then it says a lot about family, that our families contain all of those. You know, it's like the full heart. The heart is red and also dark. It also, you know, it hurts as well as it heals. And so I think the play is bold in that way, in that it's not afraid to show the harshness of reality in order for us to see the love that we need to survive this world that we're in.
If you're just joining us, I'm chatting with playwright Luis Alfaro and Sean San Jose, who's the actor and lead director of the Magic Theater. Their play Aztlan is running now until July 13th, and you can see it at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture in San Francisco. Luis, when did you write this?
Oh, I wrote it pretty fast. I work really quickly, so I've been writing pretty much, you know, what I was always told, that it takes about 2 to 3 years to write a play, but I kind of write a play a year. And we were working on another play called The Travelers that we did at the Magic, and it won this big award in San Francisco called the Glickman. And mm-hmm. then producer picked it up and took us to LA. And so everybody was staying in this gigantic house in East LA. And one day between shows, I brought in, I think, a monologue and a scene. That's all I had. And we read that. And then we said, okay, can we pursue this? So I've been doing these really beautiful drives from LA up every time school's out. I like make my way, jet my way up to the Bay. And we've been working on the play. So I think we've been working on the play now maybe for about a year and a half. Is that right, Sean? And so it came pretty, you know, for in terms of plays, it came pretty fast. And but I love this company so much, and I write for the people in the company. So one of the joys of writing when you are in an ensemble is that you know these people so well. Mm-hmm. They're like your family. But, you know, if you're a poet or a playwright, you are listening to the way they speak. You are listening to the language and the rhythm and the cadence and their feelings and their emotions and the way they pop off and the way they, like, hug you and hold you. And all of that stuff just starts to show up in the play. So, you know, in a way, I love writing for very specific actors because I know their rhythm so well. And so they help the language of the play. They help the way the play gets sort of, like, embodied every night. You know, yes. It gets manifested in a body. We know you just write words and then an actor comes in and they put it in their body and a whole other thing goes on.
I imagine that must feel really good when you see that.
It's magic. Yeah. It's kind of electricity, right? Because then you're watching and you're thinking, I just heard words, but I never saw the body on stage become the full embodiment of what these feelings are. And plays really are our feelings, right? We write for feelings. We write for the communal experience of the audience. Well, I believe very much in the old Greeks, right? The old Greek classics. So for me, I believe that we go to the theater to hear the question, and then we go home and we wrestle with the answer, right? So theater for us is a kind of version of church. You know, it's a version of coming together in a kind of community, in a communal experience, and hearing stories. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're really hard, and I try to embody all of that into one play. So I like humor. I like people having a good time. I like when people talk back at you in a play. I like all of that, right? So because we put all of that in the play, there is a kind of, you know, I was raised Pentecostal, so there's a kind of call and response that I love that happens in a play when the audience goes,
Yeah.
You know, they're making all their noises and you're like, what the? It's kind of beautiful, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. I know, for speaking as someone who's Black, like when Black people talk back to the stage or the screen, I won't do that when I come to your show.
You're welcome to.
I'm like, Aztlan, don't go there. No, I won't do that. And I can make that joke because I'm Black. But I have a question too. So is the play is divided into, is it three chapters?
I wanted to do three parts of a life. So the first part is what I call getting out of prison, right? Mm-hmm. What happens? The second part is what happens when the ancestors show up. So I have a character who literally digs their way out of the ground.
Oh.
And it's my actual grandmother from Delano. And she comes and she tells you how things went down the 22 generations, right? Mm. So that's like the middle part is like, what do we hear? And it's really borrowed loosely from one of my all-time favorite playwrights who I knew, August Wilson, who had a beautiful play called Gem of the Ocean, where there's a character named Aunt Esther, who's 100 and I think 34 years old, and she carries all the wisdom, right? And in my play, this character tells you how we got here. What was the journey of getting here? So in my head, it starts off in our ancient language, Nahuatl.
Yeah.
And then it goes into Spanish, and then it goes into English, because that's really my family history. is that I'm from southern Mexico, my family's right, so they spoke the ancient language. My dad spoke Nahuatl, and then, you know, there's Spanish and all of the journey here to the U.S. And then you start speaking English because you get assimilated, right? And then that's the journey of not only language, but it's the journey of how we travel. We travel with many different tongues. We travel in many different bodies. We travel in many different feelings. And so really, that's what I'm trying to get. And then the last part is really what happens when he meets his current family and how, like you were saying, how do we deal with the parolee who shows up and, you know, something happens in the play. There's some values that he inherited some stuff and everybody wants a piece of it. So, you know that, you know.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to tell too much. Like I said, I want to see it. But Luis, this hearing all the stuff that you're saying is very poetic. We have one more minute left, but I want to, Sean. Okay, so one of the things, Sean, I love about Aztecs, and especially Aztec dancers, are the costumes. So I want to know how y'all looking in the show.
we're looking good, if I must say so.
Okay.
But wait, the costumes are reflect the same thing that the play's themes are. It's both dual at once. So we have feathers, we have headpieces, and we got Dickies, and we got Nikes at the same time. All of it is happening at once. And one of the people you won't want to miss, which is the KLW listeners, the man that takes you on a journey on the airwaves, One Way Possible.
Yes, One Way.
As dope as he is as a DJ, and he's the dopest, as an actor, he's truly amazing. So people got it for nothing else, KW listeners, got to come out for Juan Amador.
Yes, definitely. We definitely got to come out and support One Way. Sean and Luis, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for telling us about this show. And congrats
to be
on
here.
It.
Thank you so much. It's a blessing.
Yes, thank you. All right. Sean San Jose is the lead director of the Magic Theater, and Luis Alfaro is the playwright of Aztlan. And you can see it at the Magic Theater in San Francisco now until July 13th. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rango, and thank you to our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in this holiday weekend. The Fillmore Jazz Festival is this Saturday and Sunday, or you can go to Alameda's 4th of July Parade. It's the longest in the country. And I have some homework for everyone next week. The Film Centers will start streaming on HBO Max on July 4th. And next Wednesday, we're going to have a part two on our discussion with Sinners, about Sinners. So, you know, catch up on all that for next week. Have a safe July 4th weekend. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other,